With the company full up and the training proceeding as planned, Valentine found more time to study Singh's texts and notes from his term at the staff school. Singh was generous with his own time, translating cryptic notes, if nothing else. Singh's graduation thesis, filling an entire binder, was on Winston Churchill when Britain was fighting alone during the dark years between the fall of France and Operation Barbarossa, when Germany launched her fatal attack on Soviet Russia. Valentine found the Singh thesis more interesting and readable than many of the historians he'd read in Father Max's old library. He still felt his company lacked a certain spark of initiative that Southern Command soldiers seemed to be born with. Or perhaps Valentine, with more experience in picked commands, was used to building a unit with a better grade of materials. These soldiers' instinct was to hand every problem up rather than improvise a solution and then report. He took to sending out small units with simple tasks, find a backpack he'd placed in a ravine without being spotted by pickets, and then change their orders at the last moment and kill all radio communications. He and Patel would then lead a couple of squads in a mock pursuit. If they weren't bred to think on their feet, he'd train it into them. The bright spot in the shakedown was Glass's improvement. He knew the men joked that in Ford and Chevy, Glass finally had some friends who shared his taste for mostly communicating in grunts. Glass wanted to try them out with grenade launchers or the new ultralight knee mortars from a Southern Command inventor. Valentine allowed himself one luxury, other than the occasional long shower with his gift soaps. He taught B to shine his shoes and polish his belt buckle and name tag on his A uniform. B was feminine enough to like things pretty, though he occasionally had to take the woven daisy chains of wildflowers off his pack or remove the mini bouquets peeking out the gutter at the bottom of his pistol holster. Some of the other officers in the brigade asked him how he classified her, adjutant, aide, or spouse. But Bee's elephantine grace and gentility gave her a charm that assured her a constant stream of sweets and ribbons from officers just passing through the trader's stalls and thought she'd like this. He'd even heard the command sergeant major, the senior NCO for the brigade, refer to her as their big beauty. She'd come a long way in the men's opinion since her arrival in a tutu. For relaxation, he played chess with Rand. Rand won most of the time. He was such a talented, cold player that Valentine wondered if he made intentional mistakes out of curiosity to see what his CO would do when presented with an opportunity, just to give his brain a new set of data points and challenges. Rand apparently never let anyone behind the shield of his professionalism, even when they chatted after their chess games about the progress of the company. They weren't close, but he was as fine a junior officer as Valentine could ever want. Then came the spring. The camp began to buzz. As usual, the men had somehow picked up that something was about to happen, and soon, days before Valentine got his orders to report to a final briefing. The camp grapevine proved to be right. All future leaves were canceled, the day trips into town ended, and last-minute munitions arrived, including a small supply of quickwood bullets. With the gear, the important men and women who came equipped with bodyguards, advisors, secretaries, and drivers began to arrive the next day. Valentine gave the same status report for his company 3 times in 1 day. It would have been 4, but General Lehman cut him off as Valentine spoke to him in the base officers club that never really got going. The dusty chairs, old movie posters, and license plates from the states making up the UFR all looked like they wanted to be put out of their misery.
Javelin's under step-off orders, Major. Any reason your men can't go with it?
No, General.
Heard good things about you. Gage says your men have been giving him hell playing op for.
That's kind of him, General.
Not sure I like you training grogs, though. Sniffer dogs have their purposes. But you don't want them juggling grenades.
Of course not, sir.
And they'll add a bit of verisimilitude to the, what is it, technical crew your men are supposed to look like?
That's the idea, sir.
A good one. Yours?
No, one of the Liberty recruits. She's company clerk now.
I don't trust ex-Quislings much further than I can throw them. They've caused a lot of trouble before. Hope it works out for you. Seize the briefing tonight, Valentine. Dismissed.
The briefing was held in the guarded mess hall, and using chairs begged and borrowed from every headquarters tent in the brigade, which was just as well. The blackout curtains killed airflow as well as light. More than 100 bodies burned a lot of calories over a couple of hours. The room quickly became stuffy. Lehman opened it with a few words about how javelins were used in ancient warfare to strike troops behind the front ranks. Lambert and Simi and a few new faces were there, politicians most likely. In the throng of uniformed aides and assistants stood one man in hunting gear who took a lot of notes and a few pictures. Valentine guessed he was from the Battle Cry, Southern Command's military newspaper. Conspicuously absent, at least to Valentine, were Brother Mark and Moitana's senior wolf lieutenant. Rumor had it they were already in the Kurian zone, somewhere north of Memphis. What combination of diplomacy and guerrilla havoc might already be underway? If Valentine had had his choice of assignments for this operation, he would have been with them as well. But support and logistics would be critical in an operation this far from Southern Command's bases. Singh gave some final instructions for the movement to Rally Base, the terminus for the operation's communications with GHQ, and what would one day, hopefully, be a routing station for troops staging trips to or back from the new freehold on the northern Cumberland Plateau and Appalachians. The campaign map had a few new notations. Three cats had been dispatched to Kentucky, spaced out along their line of march. Logistics commandos had infiltrated in behind the cats. Valentine wondered what they'd been told about high beam, or javelin, or whatever false information they'd been fed in case of capture. Lambert looked strained, but she collected her old briskness for a few words to the assembled officers.
Yes, this operation is a risk. But the coal country of Virginia and the legworms of Kentucky are both key to the Kurian order. Civilization needs electricity, and the people living in that civilization need protein. They'll hit back hard when they figure out what you're doing. But if you can win that fight, it'll put cracks in the foundation of every Kurian tower east of the Mississippi. Remember that. Remember also that you're not alone, even in the darkest valley of fear. The people across the Mississippi hate the Kurians just as much as we do. They just don't get a chance to do anything about it. Is Javelin Brigade up for this challenge?
Yes, ma'am!
Then send them back to hell.
Breakthrough, Western Tennessee, March. Operation Javelin and Colonel, later General, Singh's march to the Virginias, later to be studied and debated. Turning point or footnote, with good arguments on both sides, began with a masterstroke. The 1,000-foot Kurian Tower at Mississippi Point had stood for two generations. Every now and then, Southern Command would bring some heavy artillery forward and shell it for an hour or so, just to see the light show as mysterious rippling bands of violet rose and detonated the shells a mile from target. The scientists from the Miskatonic attending these shows tried to study the effect with their poor collection of instruments, but always left flummoxed. The Kurian in that tower, controlling the Mississippi between Memphis and Paducah, is called the Goober Maker. Even the best hunter, sneaking out into the woods around that tower, slowly becomes confused and disoriented. The more cautious, or maybe luckier, staggered away, underwear sometimes loaded like a sopping, sagging diaper, wondering what their name is. Most recover their sensibilities and memory eventually. The Miskatonic considered the Goobermaker a powerful Kurian, feudal lord to sub-Kurians stretched from the outskirts of Nashville to Memphis and into southwestern Kentucky. He makes claim to the river as well, extracting tolls for water traffic and ever more exorbitant fees in auras for cargo cutting across his territory to the Ohio or the Tennessee when Southern Command gets the upper hand against the gunboats of the River Patrol. Returning from the ammo dump, Glass carried the last boxes of brass, lead, and smokeless powder for the 50 calibers.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Are you fucking kidding me, sir, Corporal? You'll follow orders just like me, no matter how ridiculous.
It was the last week of February, and spring peeped through the twigs and breaks in the iron-gray clouds as a bitterly cold storm blowing in from Canada exhausted itself somewhere over southern Missouri. Their assault barge yawned before them at the end of a boarding plank. It was a Kurian transport for Aura fodder, and someone had painted the inside a soothing pink. It looked like a giant mouth extending a sickly, rusted tongue held down by a 12-foot depressor. Valentine smelled of sandalwood. He treated himself to a long shower to relieve the jump-off tension. He looked out at his company through the Halloween mask rubber-banded across his face. The soldiers looked like a bunch of burned matches with tinfoil wrapped around their head except for eye holes. Glass had been one of the last to resist, but he pulled a dull black spray-painted mask down around his head.
At least it's warm.
Patel stepped forward with a pin to poke breathing apertures around his mouth and nose.
Sergeant Major! Shine his side out, remember? Glass is grouchy enough without getting brain bake.
It wasn't a very good joke, but Valentine was relieved to hear it. The men smelled nervous, that sharp electric acid odor of anxiety. Word had filtered up through the NCOs that some of the men were remembering what happened to Quislings caught fighting for Southern Command. The Kurians developed imaginative and painful manners of extracting auras from those guilty of such treasons. Every Southern Command soldier knew that if captured, they could probably expect to be shuttled to some work camp or other. They were young and fit, after all. Officers could expect a good deal of interrogation. Leading figures of the resistance, majors, colonels, and especially generals, could expect a long period of wear and tear under drugs or blunter instruments before the inevitable show trial. Valentine could never find it in himself to condemn those captured in the Kurian zone who confessed to plans ranging from blowing up hospitals to poisoning youth vanguard bake sale cookies, because the confession was undoubtedly forced and false.
We're ordered to load, Major Valentine.
Preville was a nearsighted company comm tech with an old Motorola headset wired to the pack radio. He made do with some old round glass women's frames that didn't do much for his face. Valentine, through Rand, had insisted that he see a Southern Command doc and get some regulation glasses. But Preville liked how he looked in his lenses. The new ones hadn't shown up in time anyway.
You heard the man, Sergeant Major Patel.
Load up and board! Load up and board!
Word had it that General Lehman was watching the embarkation, going from formation to formation, giving a last few words of encouragement. He hadn't made it to Valentine's group. Odd-looking and inhuman in the painted tinfoil that obscured hair and ears, they filed into the barge.
Enjoy, guys. This'll be the easiest part of the whole trip.
With Ediac, the company clerk, and Preville trailing behind, Valentine boarded.
Last on gets to be the first on the Kurian shore.
The Skeeter fleet and logistics commandos who'd arranged for the barges had chalked all sorts of helpful messages on the inside. Valentine could see, too. Thank you for choosing Mudskipper Cruise Lines. We accept responsibility for nothing but getting you over and hauling your body back. And tetanus shots are recommended for all passengers. As the recently constructed loading doors closed, a third came into view. No point worrying about it now. This first part of the operation was secret enough that even Valentine knew only the outline. His only orders were to get in column with the rest of Jala's command and move out to the northeast along an old highway. The Southern Command men crossed the water toward shore through the darkness. They fiddled and adjusted the tinfoil headdresses as they waded in the slough between two sandbars, heading for blue signal lights on the shore proper. Upstream and down, there were more boats and barges landing, and he could just make out lines of craft of all descriptions waiting to vomit out men and material into the moonlight. Sailors and logistic commandos had set up lines, and netted bags full of gear came ashore like a parade of lumpy bats swinging in the wind.
Make to Route Green. The colonel wants us to take over for the Wolf Pathfinders.
Valentine had heard that Southern Command was supposed to be bringing a trio of big guns across the river, and from the sound of things, the rumors were correct. Word had it that they were Harry, Hermione, and Ron. Hermione was famous for having fired the first shot of the Archangel counterattack. Southern Command was sending them into the Kurian zone with the same long-range blessing. He instinctively checked the big numeral watch looped through his top buttonhole. 0528. The detail would be of interest to some historian or other. Valentine hoped it wouldn't be a new Universal Church archivist collecting notes for a paper on the suppression of the Cumberland insurgency.
Men, form up!
As Valentine's men formed into ragged lines on the shore, he wished that he could find a high spot to see the light show. The Goobermaker's strange defense had been described to him, but he'd never seen the effect personally. All he saw was the occasional flicker of a shell heading east through breaks in the trees.
Move out!
Valentine noted the lack of counter-battery fire. One would think that the local Quislings would at least have mortars in place to harass the landing by now. Perhaps they were as wary of the Goobermaker's woods as the wolves and cats. Up ahead, pairs of wolves marked the path to the old highway, looking even dumber than Valentine's company, with painted tinfoil topping their weathered buckskins. The trail up from the riverbank passed through a wood before joining the old federal route. As they moved through the brush, Valentine's men broke themselves off into prearranged, corporal-led units. The wolves were glad to be relieved and hurried off in the direction of the firing. It was a strange sort of KZ. As far as Valentine could tell, the Goobermaker made no attempt to build farms or settlements. He kept the old federal highway clear enough, though as they came into town, he saw brush growing out of broken windows of otherwise fine brick buildings. The town looked like a decrepit old man, untrimmed eyebrows, ear, and nostril hair. Jala arrived and set up temporary HQ in an abandoned playground outside an old primary school. He'd ripped open a big triangle from his mask, so it only half obscured his face, making him look a bit like the Phantom of the Opera. As the rest of the support battalion showed up, he distributed the units so they'd be ready to move north.
There's quite a show if you want to go up to the school roof, Valentine. Just follow the power cords from the mobile generator.
Valentine left Rand at Company HQ with Glass and the heavy weapons grogs and headed into the school, B trailing dutifully behind. Valentine had long since given up trying to get her to do anything but watch over him. Evidently, he'd replaced Hoffman Price in her life in some manner. He followed the cords up the stairs and to the roof. The main signals team was hard at work, with Singh's chief of staff, Nowak, throwing orders like hand grenades. She was a rather willowy woman with baby-soft skin, though that too was obscured by tinfoil. Valentine brought up his binoculars, focused on the torch-like flicker 6 or 7 miles away. The Goobermaker's turret snail tower, topped by what looked like a broken minaret, was aflame, sending a long spiral of smoke like a question mark into the sky. Artillery shells landed somewhere in the hills well south of the tower, looking like distant lightning in the growing dawn. Big horizon-shaping flashes punctuated by smaller bursts. Someone was putting up a steel curtain between the Goobermaker's lands and Memphis. Southern Command was apparently giving everything it had in the eastern approaches to start them off.
They did it, eh, Noack?
Really and truly. Chatter says they've already captured a Kurian alive. It may be the old bastard himself. They've sealed him inside a glass fish tank, and a couple cats and a bear team are hauling ass back for the river.
Has that ever happened before?
If it had, guys like us wouldn't have heard of it. Of course, they're yakking about it almost in the clear. Might be a diversion, trying to sucker in a big effort to recapture him, catch the patrol under our guns.
As the sun began to rise on the horizon, Valentine considered when his men would be on the move again. He suspected that when they did, his troops, with their uniforms designed to confuse identification, might have to lead the way again. Best see if they could be relieved and get them fed to keep their strength up for the next lap. Valentine organized the distribution of hot chicory coffee and sandwiches for his strung-out platoons. Jolly had a quick meeting, showing the next route that they'd take as soon as a few more companies of guards arrived, and set the next leg of the march to begin at noon in any case. Singh wanted everyone through the Goobermaker's lands and out the other end, heading for Kentucky as soon as possible. A tired-looking figure in black rode into camp on a lather-streaked mule. It was Brother Mark, under a thick coat of dirt and dead twigs. He handed his mount to Groom and tottered to the field kitchen. Valentine found a folding camp stool and brought it to it. The man smelled of sweat and smoke.
You have my profound gratitude, son. You wouldn't know if my baggage has been unloaded.
You need a change of clothes?
My goose-down pillow. I've been on my feet or in my saddle since... Is it Sunday already? Since Friday morning. I feel as though I could sleep propped up against the wall over there.
I thought only the wolves went over before Saturday night.
Oh, I was well ahead of them. Meetings to attend. You can remove that ridiculous tinfoil now, young man. Not that it ever provided anything but psychological comfort.
Meetings?
Oh. Yes. Concerning the settlement of the estate of the late Re-Acractus's. I beg your understanding. The Goobermaker, you boys call her. The Goobermaker's estate.
Who attended this meeting?
Some of the local Kurians. He was quite unpopular with the Nashville clan, and Memphis only just tolerated him because of his military acumen. When she switched over to female and started butting off her own clan, that was the last straw. The feel went out that Memphis was willing to withdraw her support. If I were in the old bishop's palace after a night like that, I'd take a steam with a pair of flexible 14-year-olds scrubbing me down. I'm reduced to cleaning my own feet. I wish I could indulge my humanist patriotism in a more comfortable manner.
But you're saying the Kurians ganged up on one of their own?
Not so much ganged up as withdrew their minds from her contact, leaving her rather alone at a key moment. Once the conspiracy started, everyone wanted to join. There's an old proverb from the Silk Road. A falling camel attracts many knives.
So the tinfoil was pointless?
Not pointless. Useless, maybe. But it did its job. Everyone was afraid to set foot on this side of the river near that great tower. It gave the troops confidence. I understand the bears were quite a sight, blowing open holes in the bottom of the tower with turbans of glittering foil wrapped around their heads.
Those Kurians are not going to be happy when we march into Kentucky.
Memphis or Nashville don't give two figs about the legworm ranchers. The only ones who claim control over central Kentucky is the ordinance up in Ohio, and they're happy to cause trouble for them. They see it as removing two turds with one flush. Is that how you say it? I'm still not used to all this colorful cracker barrel talk you fighting men use down here.
There's a rumor she was captured.
No. One of her detached buds. Developed enough to inherit much of her mind. He may prove useful.
How do you meet?
Sorry to interrupt, Major Valentine.
What is it, Sergeant Major?
Colonel Jollis called for all the staff-level officers, sir. The route's been changed. Moitana's wolves have captured a motor pool and fueling station. We're to move there at once.
Go and line your men up neatly, Major. I think I shall despair of my pillow and just sleep on my coat for whatever length of time God and Colonel Sang allow. Oh, dear. It looks like rain. As if I'm not uncomfortable enough.
By nightfall, they were almost out of the Goobermaker's territory, camped at the captured garage that reminded Valentine of the rig yard he'd briefly seized back in his days as a wolf lieutenant. This one had no organic labor force, however, just a few mechanics and relief drivers who took a motor bus in from Memphis every day. Just before setting off on the hard march for the garage, Jala had ordered the men to discard their tinfoil and officially announced the destruction of the Goobermaker's tower. Valentine wasn't able to determine which bit of news raised the men's morale more, but he was glad to feel air on his skin again. The march out of the Mississippi camp marked the last time that Valentine's company stepped in ranks and files together for weeks. Once out of sight of the river valley, they were put to work, scattered into details and squads, gathering news and sustenance, watching road crossings, finding fords or paths, siphoning gasoline, and warning off wandering locals. 2 days later, they crossed into Kentucky, following old Route 79. Patel and a platoon rode scout, traveling ahead or around the flanks to major intersections where they could idle beside a utility pole or beneath a bridge, quietly keeping watch. Glass and Rand stayed with the main body at company headquarters. Valentine switched between the scouts and the men riding with the logistics commandos gathering supplies. Valentine was happy to quit Tennessee, mostly because it meant he wouldn't have to deal with Papa Riesling anymore. Riesling was an unpleasant individual, a former logistics commando who'd married and settled on the fringe of the Goobermaker's grounds north of Clarksville. He was a strange figure of a man, old yet hale, thick-haired but gray flecked with white. He didn't like Valentine from the moment he first set eyes on him, when a local underground contact arranged a meeting. Perhaps it was due to B, who didn't like the look of the old Dairy Queen garbage nook where they met while Riesling's brother-in-law kept watch from the roof. Riesling considered the entire Southern Command invasion of Kentucky, the first true offensive across the Mississippi in the history of that freehold, a deep-seated plot to make his life difficult and bring the Reapers down on him.
Now, I can make a pork loin disappear or 10 pounds of flour and molasses, but this? 2,000 eggs, powdered or fresh? 30 pounds of salt? 600 chickens at the very least? And as many more as I can provide? Fruit juice or dried fruit? Where am I supposed to get dried fruit by the goddamn barrel, you?
Nobody's gonna die if you miss a few line items. It's a great help to us to get anything. Every mouthful you provide means less that comes out of stores that we carry along for emergencies.
Okay, 3 weeks ago, I was told to start setting aside food for a big operation. I thought it would be a company of wolves. Got a pen of year-old pigs and 2 50-pound bags of beans the local production officer doesn't know exist. Thought I'd done my job, and done it well. Then half of the goddamn Southern Command crosses over the river and stands here, mouths open like baby birds, expecting me to stuff them.
Old tricks are usually the best. Find a church relief warehouse, loot it, and set it on fire.
And have church inquisitors questioning half of Clarksville? No thank you, Lieutenant.
That's Major.
And that's why we're in the state we're in. Kids with mama's milk still on their lips throwing rank around.
It had been a while since anyone called Valentine kid. Brother Mark's my sons hardly counted. Churchmen of his rank called everyone obviously beneath their age son or daughter.
Just give us what you can. Even if it's just those yearling pigs and the beans.
Airbrain operation you're on, Lieutenant. Major. You want to fool the Kurians? You gotta go one tippy toe. You boys are stomping into the KZ in clown shoes. They're gonna slap down on you hard.
Just get us what you can. We'll be back tonight with a truck.
The supplies showed up, including a surprising quantity of eggs. The underground men who helped them load it said practically every family in Clarksville had given up little reserves of food they kept in case of shortages. Word had gone out that eggs were needed, and they came in straw-packed, ribboned baskets. Many of the eggs had been decorated using vinegar dyes, red and blue mostly, with gold stars stuck on. "God bless you," read the tiny cursive ink letters on one. But Riesling just stood with his arms crossed in an old overcoat, watching them load.
"You'll get your food. The people here are gonna pay for every bit. Mark my words."
Kentucky's hills exploded into spring colors. Fireworks displays of wildflower and dogwood blossoms. Valentine would take parties out to show them trees bearing wild legworms. The crawlers would stay in the branches, devouring bark, twig, and leaf alike, until they became so heavy they either snapped the branches or bent them until they were lowered gently to earth. Then they commenced grazing in their long, crooked furrows. Valentine changed back into his legworm leathers, adding Velcro strips for Southern Command insignia. He had been dreading the Kurian reaction to their march with every step into Kentucky, waiting to see what shape the reaction would take. But the march covered miles, with not much more difficulty than they'd experienced on the practice marches in northern Arkansas and the Missouri Boot Heel. Every time he topped a rise, every time they took a bend, every time they broke out of a forest or heavy brush and into pasture, Valentine expected to see them, campfires and tents and columns of motor vehicles. But the landscape remained as empty as it had when he followed Hoffman Price across the Tennessee and into Kentucky. B seemed happy to be back. When they cut legworm trails, little rises of plant growth and dirt that looked like planted furrows cut by a drunk plowing farmer, B urged him to follow. Some sense of hers allowed her to tell which way the legworm had gone, though unless the marks were very fresh, Valentine couldn't make head from tail. The legworm ranchers were a clannish bunch. Some sat you down and offered pie. Others would chase you off with birdshot. And that was just for a few wanderers crossing their grazing lands. Valentine wondered how they'd react to the appearance of better than 2,000 Southern Command soldiers. South of Bowling Green, Valentine and a team of his men idled in the bed of a running pickup at dawn, keeping warm by sitting either in the cab or atop the engine-warmed hood. They'd been tasked with meeting a pair of cats who were supposed to guide them into the legworm bluegrass. The pickup sat beneath a power pylon. Birds, with their usual good judgment, had transformed it into a high-rise condominium. The men passed around thermoses of sage tea and swapped war stories. Valentine shared a story of a battle between two legworm clans he'd witnessed, with the gunmen on each side using their beasts as a cross between World War I entrenchments and 18th century fighting sail. Valentine left to take a leak.
Damn!
Valentine spotted a binding twine lasso attaching his ankle to the mufflerless exhaust system on the truck. Two men jumped off the front of the truck, coming to his aid.
You okay, Major?
He deserves it for almost splattering me with pee. I taped two grenades under your truck and pegged the pins to come out when you drove away. You clowns are lucky I recognized him.
Who the hell are you?
Gentlemen, allow me to introduce you to Alessa Duvalier.
That's smoke to all of you, including Major Valentine here.
This is one of Southern Command's best cats. I've covered more miles with her than any living thing. They pulled you into this operation.
Thanks to you, I'm rated as one of Southern Command's expert cats on the bluegrass. I've been working Kentucky since the fall, escorting that churchman around.
He's cheery company.
Never more so than when he's trying to stick a spitty finger inside you, horny old goat.
Another woman, hair knife cut high and tight into a cross between a mohawk and a mullet, rose from the ditch running along the road. She had legworm leather trousers and a poncho concealing what looked to be a military carbine. A camouflage bandana added a festive touch to her neck. The woman extended hands and fingerless gloves and gave a strong handshake.
This is Vet, Val. She was blooded in Missouri. It's quieter there now, so Southern Command retasked her here because she was born in Bowling Green. Vet, this is Ghost. I went to Colorado and across Nebraska and Kansas with him.
Pleased to see you're still alive, Valentine.
If you watch him close when he walks, you'll see that he's had some near misses.
Hope you learn as much from her as I did.
She's smarter than you when it comes to picking a fight.
So, what do you got for us?
You guys have moved fast and hard. We're going to take you to a sort of a feudal lord. He's got several tribes united under him.
Including the old crew you ran with, the Bulletproof. I recognize the cut of your leathers.
No other hints, Smoke?
You'll be relieved to know you're about to be reinforced. A third of Kentucky is mounting Worm to fight.
Worm Ranchers fight?
I think the corporal here means on our side.
Six clans have come together.
Duvalier glared at the doubters. The fire in her eyes reminded Valentine of how pretty she was when her real self peeped through the scruffy exterior.
That churchman may like playing stink finger with the female help, but he's one hell of a diplomat. Every time things heated up, he calmed him down and got him talking again. It's as much his triumph as it is Karis's.
Who's Karis?
He's a Bowling Green boy, too. He's just what the cause needs, a visionary.
The men of the brigade waited. With some fresh bread and Kentucky honey in them, they were in good spirits. They spent most of their days lounging on a gentle hillside forming a natural amphitheater, warming in April sunshine that promised summer on the way. During Valentine's training and time in the bear caves of Pacific Command, he had sometimes spent a few hours at night in the rec room. They had an LCD TV rig there, and he watched old movies on disc. One bear favorite was an old movie called Highland. While Valentine found it interesting enough, especially the sweeping images of scenery, he'd forgotten the movie until he saw Karis emerge from his vast tent. He immediately thought, that's the Highlander. Karis had the same strong face, long hair, and impressive build, though the hair was stringier and the build wasn't enhanced by camera angle. He wore a big pocketed waxed canvas coat that hung to mid-thigh and rather striking pants that were legworm leather on the inside and what looked like corduroy on the outside. His soft brown boots, with just a hint of felt showing at the top, made Valentine rather jealous. They looked durable and comfortable. Followed by deputations from the six clans supporting him and by Brother Mark, who looked pleased for the first time since Valentine had known him, Karis approached an old pasture tree that had been butchered just that morning for firewood. Earlier in the morning, Valentine had watched two men working a long saw cutting it off, but had wondered why they went up the tree and sawed off limbs instead of simply felling it in the first place. Valentine recognized the honey-colored hair of Tika among the tribal dignitaries. She'd apparently assumed some role of importance within the Bulletproof. Karis mounted the stump with the aid of a ladder. Valentine wondered how he'd look to the men in the pasture or on the lower slopes of the hill. A statue atop a column?
A leathery worm rider stepped forward.
Let the Kentucky Alliance take heed! Our chief is about to speak!
This is a sight I've dreamed of for a long time. Y'all don't know how happy you've made me, marching to these quiet hills. It's been a long time since the Stars and Stripes has been carried openly, pridefully across these hills. Let me formally welcome you as friends. Am I more valuable? As allies! Some of you went to school. I only had one teacher my whole life. A simple man, a plumbing contractor before 2022. That man was my father. He taught me to ride. He taught me to shoot. He taught me to tell the truth. One day I was looking at pictures of animals of the world. I liked big cats, lions, and black panthers and tigers. He told me that one tiger needed to eat as many as 300 deer in a year. 300! Of course, the tiger must eat them one at a time. No tiger kills 300 deer at once. Imagine, though, if those 300 deer could talk as we do, if they could take the tiger's tally, if they could organize against this tiger, if 300 deer together hunted the one tiger, threw themselves against it, fighting and goring and kicking, well, I reckon that tiger would never hunt again. We have one great advantage over the Kurians. Human beings naturally come together, the way water droplets find their way to pools. The Kurians like to remain individual drops. Divided, all we can do is crawl to the Kurians and lick their boots, begging not to be killed. Their tigers are the master of any one of us. United, we will hunt the tigers! I'm going to ask you to follow me east into the mountains. There, we'll start the biggest tiger hunt you've ever seen. Then, with the forces that are meeting there, we'll come back and start taking over town after town, county after county here in Kentucky. Can I count on the men of Arkansas, of Texas, of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Missouri? We're pledged to you, Wildcats, Gunslingers, Coonskins, Bulletproof, and Mammoths. And of course, my own Perseids!
Valentine felt a surge of pride and excitement. If he understood it right, Javelin was now the largest operation against the Kurians since Archangel. Lambert and Brother Mark and the rest had told them that they'd have support of some of the legworm ranchers in Kentucky. He thought they meant foodstuffs and fuel. He'd never dreamed they'd be fighting at their side. Why had they kept so much secret from the officers involved? To avoid disappointment if Karras turned out to be a windbag full of bluster and promises? Or did Lambert feel it necessary to keep this from Southern Command's own higher-ups? Valentine smiled as B thumped him on the chest, not really understanding the reason for the cheering, but enjoying the mood. The troops seemed thrilled that Kentucky wasn't just supporting their advance, but coming to their side. And Valentine was considering the possibility of informants high up in Southern Command's officer list. A young member of the Alliance flipped a brightly polished nickel to Valentine, then moved on to hand out more to others. It bore an imposing stamp of Karras in profile. The reverse had a five-pointed star with a 10 at the center and $10 written along the edge. Valentine examined the engraving. A faint halo had been etched around the profile.
The king's coin! A lot more where these came from.
Long live the king of Kentucky, then. What do you suppose we can buy with it?
Whole lot of trouble. If this man wants us calling him king.
Karras's coins turned out to be only so much shiny dross when it came to bartering with other legworm tribes. Valentine's company went back to trading the crank-powered radios, rifles, and learned to read Bibles for butter and eggs. But the legworm riders did offer spare worms, rigged for hauling cargo. Valentine's company received two, one to carry burdens while the other grazed in its wake, with roles switched the next day. Every third day, the column rested now to give the worms time to feed and recover. For all their size, they could be delicate if mishandled or underfed. As they passed the more settled central part of Kentucky, the land became a patchwork of small towns and huge clannish ranches. The towns were controlled by badges, but rarely saw a reaper. Though Valentine heard fireside tales of bounty hunters and human traffickers who collected criminals and troublemakers. Contacts with the underground dried up once they reached the ranch lands. Though the soldiers broke into a few locked NUC storage rooms in the dead of night, Valentine scanning for reapers and his sharpshooters standing by with their blue-striped magazines and the rifles, they rarely returned to Javelin with full carts. Where no small, easy game were to be had, Valentine felt it necessary to organize a hunt for larger prey.
This is what's called hitting them where they ain't.
Second platoon was dispersed before Patel on a steep hillside overlooking a railroad cut. Valentine stood between Patel and Glass, who had the Grog's 50 caliber set up within a blind of machete-sculpt brush. Wolf scouts had relayed a report of a lightly guarded cargo train heading north on the Lexington track, and Valentine's company was dispatched to hit it if it looked like it contained anything useful. Below them, an engine and 10 boxcars stood on a single track in front of a blocked bridge. The engine puffed like an impatient fat man. Valentine stood above Patel, watching one of his Kentucky recruits talking to the engineer from the cover of a stand of thick redbud. A few other members of 1st Platoon stood, looking at the blocked bridge. Another pair of soldiers, Rutherford and DuSable, who Valentine considered his two coolest heads, stood at the back of the caboose, swapping some captured new Universal Church activity books and Lexington newspapers for cigarettes and what looked like a sheaf of mimeographed crossword puzzles with the guards in the armored caboose. Whether the engineer wondered why some technical crew just happened to be blocking a bridge where trains were running yesterday, Valentine couldn't say. Crow, the soldier in question, was a good talker and had worked rail crew as a boy and into his early manhood. The binoculars in Valentine's hands stayed steady on the armored caboose. Patel watched the gunner in the little bubble just behind the engine. They were woefully attentive to duty, experienced enough on the lines to know that any unexpected pause called for extra vigilance.
Faces. And the boxcar. It's not cargo, it's fodder.
Valentine swiveled his glasses over a few degrees. His vision blurred for a moment as Redbud intervened, and then he saw it. A pair of haunted eyes looking out through the bars, knuckles white as the prisoner hefted himself up to the air holes at the top of the car. He did some quick math. Maybe 400 human souls behind that puffing engine, bound for destruction.
No point hitting it now. Nothing we can use.
Shut up, Glass.
A clean-cut young officer left the caboose. Another railroad guard trailed behind him, wearing the harassed look of adjutants everywhere in any army. After a conference with the engineer, they approached Crow, who gestured for them to come and look at the bridge. They walked out to the edge of the gorge, and Crow pointed to the pilings at the base of the bridge. A couple of the idling workers fiddled with the pile of shovels and picks at the edge of the road. Another went back to a captured pickup with a freshly painted logo the platoon had been using, avoiding the officer. A perfectly natural move. Captain Lahav always told Valentine not to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. This would be as good an opportunity as they would get with this train. Valentine looked again at the young officer, wondered why someone hardened by experience wasn't on this trip. Maybe he was fresh out of some new Universal Church Leadership Academy, telling himself that this winnowing, distasteful in the particular, helped the species in general. Tough luck, kid.
Give the strike signal, Sergeant Major. Glass, have the Grogs hit the engine first, then the caboose.
Rutherford and DuSable shoved the newspapers in their vests, reaching for the small cylindrical grenades that hung within. Glass made a face, but patted Ford on the shoulder and pointed at the engine. He and Chevy took hold of their 50.
Open fire.
The glass of the cupola turned to spider web and blood. Crow froze up. One good shove, and he could have sent the young officer headfirst into the gorge. Valentine silently implored him to move, but he ducked down at the gunfire. Another of Valentine's men in gray denim, a thick-armed ex-motorcycle cavalry named Salazar, raised a shovel and bashed the adjutant with it as Crow still gaped. The soldier didn't have time to make sure of the adjutant, for the lieutenant had his pistol out. The flat of the shovel caught the lieutenant under the chin, tumbling him into the gorge. Plumes of dust spouted up from the ventilators on the roof of the caboose. Rutherford and DuSable crawled like fast-moving snakes toward the front of the train, sheltering next to the wheels of the boxcars, where the men in the caboose couldn't bring their mounted weapons to bear. The Grogs shifted their 50 to the armored caboose, emptying the rest of the box of ammunition, punching holes around the firing slits.
You've done this well in training. Now do it well in combat. Third platoon, covering positions. Second platoon, forward!
Check fire! Check before you shoot! There are friendlies down there!
They did it well, moving all at once at a rush. Third platoon, higher on the hillside, moved forward to the prepared positions. Valentine, half sliding down the steep hill nearest the cut, landed and glanced at the front of the train. One of his men was already inside the engine compartment, waving off additional fire. At the bridge, there was nothing to see but Crow, kneeling beside the soldier who clobbered the lieutenant with the shovel, a bloody pistol in his hand. Bee loped after Valentine, one of her sawed-off shotguns in one hand and an assault rifle in the other, moving forward like a fencer with the assault rifle pointed at the caboose, the shotgun held up and back.
Bee, get Cabbage over to Crow. He's not calling man down, but I think Salazar is hurt.
Cabbage was the company medic, when he wasn't assisting the cook. Formerly a demi-doc in the KZ, he'd gotten sick of signing unfitness certifications.
Patel, cover the cars until we know for sure what's inside.
Valentine looked beneath the cars, searching for explosives. He'd heard of the Kurians sending decoy trains lined with plastic explosive and claymore mines to take out guerrillas when someone hit the kill switch. This didn't look to be that kind of train, but it was best to make sure. No sign of strange wiring leading from the caboose. Valentine looked through one of the bullet holes into the armored caboose, saw a twitching foot. Rutherford slunk up beside him. Valentine noticed blood running down from his forehead, already caking into cherry flakes.
I'm going in.
Let me go first, sir.
You're wounded.
It ain't mine, Major. I got some on me when Disable and I were checking for booby traps. It was dripping out of the caboose. The cars look clear. Disable's checking the rest forward.
Rutherford was a cool head. Second platoon had taken up firing positions, covering the caboose and the rest of the cars up to the engine. There was some trouble with the caboose's metal door. It was either jammed good or latched from the inside.
Stand back!
As B pulled the steel door back, Rutherford slipped in, pistol held in a weaver stance. Nothing but blood and body parts awaited them. Valentine checked the radio log. The set itself was as dead as the gunners inside the caboose, but there was a notation that an unscheduled stop had happened, with approximate location, and that the message had been acknowledged by LEX. Lexington, Valentine guessed. They opened up the boxcars, giving in to the pleading and pounding from within.
Liberators! They're liberators!
Better in shit detail, eh, Rutherford?
The liberated thronged around the soldiers, some in blue and yellow and pink clothing that looked like hospital scrubs woven out of paper fiber. In some Kurian zones, they even begrudged you the clothes on your back when selected for harvesting.
Please stay close to the train. Don't wander off.
Valentine walked up the line to check on Salazar. Salazar had two bullets in him, or rather, through him. The Quisling adjutant had opened up on him at point blank, and Salazar still managed to half-decapitate the Quisling before Crow finally fired his pistol. Crow looked miserable, rubbing at Salazar's blood on his hands like Lady Macbeth. Cabbage stood up from his side as Valentine reached him.
I think he'll live, sir. Four neat little holes, two coming in and two going out. His left lung is deflated, and he may have lost a big chunk of kidney, but that's just a guess without x-rays.
The nearest machine is probably in Nashville, so for now, I'll take your word for it.
They had an impromptu officers' conference while 2nd Platoon distributed food from the stores in the forwardmost boxcar to the fodder. Valentine had to snap Crow out of his misery.
Crow, forget it. I need you in the here and now, okay?
Yes, sir.
Salazar's either going to make it or not. You poured iodoform into the wound and applied pressure. The rest is up to him and the medics. Worrying about 15 minutes ago won't cause him to draw one breath more. Answer a few questions for me, and then you can go back to him.
Yes, sir.
They got off a message to Lexington. What happens if guerrillas hit a train?
It depends on if the train is just reported overdue or if they called in that they were being attacked.
Let's assume the worst.
They'll send out an armored train and motorbike and horse cavalry, backed up by at least a few companies of infantry and some light artillery and gun wagons. There's never been more than a few dozen guerrillas here. Too many Kurian-friendly legworm clans.
How do they track the gorillas?
Reapers, usually. I've seen them get off trains myself.
Reapers mean there have to be a Kurian controlling them.
Valentine didn't add that they might also be controlled by the strange organization known as the Twisted Cross. Ever since the Nebraska Golden Ones smashed their facility south of Omaha, there were only a few odd units of them scattered around.
I was told there's a Kurian in charge of rail security who goes around in an armored train. I never saw him, though, just as Reapers.
Brave of him to venture out.
Yes.
What about the fodder? We can't take these people over ridges.
Agreed, Sergeant Major. We'll have to use the train. We've crossed over enough old tracks this week. Is there a line we could use?
Well, let's see, sir. There's an old spur that heads off east at first, hooks around more south, skirts the south end of the Boone Woods. It fed some mines that went dry. That'll get us back toward Brigade, maybe even a little ahead of them.
Boone Woods? That's what they call the Daniel Boone National Forest around here, right?
Well, yeah.
What's the problem?
Major, it's really overgrown. The engine has a brush cutter on it, but we'll have to go slow, move fallen logs and whatnot ourselves. It'll catch up to us easy, especially since it's obvious where the trail is leading.
We'll blow track at the cutoff.
That'll only slow them up for an hour or so. Their rail gangs could do anything but build a bridge in just a few minutes.
I don't suppose there are any bridges.
Lots, but they'll dismount and follow, if we even get that far. Somebody might have torn up track for scrap steel or used ties to build a cabin. You never know.
We'll risk it. At the very least, these people will be no worse off than they were before.
Valentine joined Preble up at the ridgeline at Company HQ, where he talked to Singh over a scrambler. Singh didn't sound happy about it. Valentine had been assigned to conduct logistical raids, not start small-scale guerrilla warfare on the Cumberland a week before they were due in Virginia. But Singh was too good an officer not to see a chance to bag a bunch of railroad security troops more adept at flushing guerrillas out of the tall timber than facing combined arms attacks.
I've only got a few wolves left at headquarters. Most of them are elsewhere.
I'll try to keep the Reapers homing in on life sign.
Valentine broadcast in the clear to Allegheny HQ that they'd intercepted the train carrying Dr. Faustus and he was safely on the way back. Some lonely slob, probably working the transmitter out of some shack near Mount Eagle and creating nonsensical chatter between Singh's HQ and the mythical operations headquarters, acknowledged. That would give the Kurian intelligence services something to chew on for a while as they examined the manifests of those shipped north as aura fodder. Hopefully some selection officer would be chopped for a screw-up that existed only in Valentine's imagination. It also might give the impression of a quick, fast-moving raid. If half the pursuit forces headed into the Kentucky Hills following their foot trail, that many less would be left to pursue the train. The toughest part of getting going again was convincing the transportees to climb back into the boxcars. Valentine didn't blame them. The Kurians hadn't bothered to provide much in the way of food or sanitary services. They refilled the car's big yellow freshwater jugs from a handy stream, and his troops shared out what rations they had handy. Valentine sent Rand with the carts that would have carried off whatever goodies they could have raided from the train, plus the small amount of supplies they'd bartered or scavenged on this trip, back east toward headquarters. He put Crow up front and the wounded Salazar with company headquarters in the caboose, now freed of bodies, but not the sticky, coppery smell of blood, despite a quick swilling out. Cabbage already had an IV going, with Salazar as comfortable as doping could make him. Even better, the intercom with the engine still worked. B didn't like being in the train, for whatever reason. She clapped her hand over her head and made nervous noises. Valentine had nightmares of meeting a high-speed relief train coming south head-on and had to make plans for the abandonment of their charges. But they made Crow's turnoff, and they moved down the old spur line. The terrain around here was too hilly for good legworm ranching, but herds of sheep and goats grazed on the slopes. They passed signage for old coal mines, saw the rusting, vine-covered remains of old conveyors and towers, frowning down on slag piles tufted with weeds, and bracken fighting for a precarious existence on soil that had accumulated in nooks and crannies. In some places, more recent strip mining scarred the hills, leaving the Kentucky ridges looking like an abandoned, opened-up cadaver on an autopsy table. They set up watches, allowing most of his men to rest. There was little enough left to eat. Valentine didn't think much of their guide. a rather slow man in his 30s, who thought that, by guide, his duties required telling old family stories about who got married in which valley, the hunting abilities of his preacher's astonishing coon dogs, and the time Len Partridge got his index finger blown off by old Murphy for sneak visiting Mrs. Murphy while he was off gathering legworm egg skin. Valentine did manage to glean that the Currians still sent trains into this region in the fall to trade for legworm meat, though it was sandwiched into a story about a wounded hawk his cousin Brady nursed back to health and trained for duck hunting. Luckily, there were only brief delays due to downed trees on the tracks. The men moved, or in one case dynamited, the trees with high-spirited enthusiasm. The audacity of a theft of an entire train had been the highlight of the march across Kentucky. But the sinking sun set Valentine nervously pacing the caboose until he realized he was making the rest of the occupants nervous, and he distracted himself by discussing Salazar's condition with Cabbage. They came to a small river and stopped to check the bridge's soundness. Valentine thanked his lucky star that he had such a diverse group of ex-Quislings in his company. He consulted his map and saw that the river arced up into the hills where Sing was headquartered. Sheep and goats and several legworms grazed in the valley.
Sir, we can take a span out with dynamite and slow up the pursuit.
Not the Reapers. They'd come hot and hard with men on horses or motorbikes or bicycles homing in on the crowded life sign in the rail cars.
I want a conference with all officers. Give the refugees 15 minutes out of the cars.
They traded the captured rifles and shotguns and boxes of ammunition with the Shepherd families for a generous supply of sheep and goats. The shepherds and goatherds thought him a madman. He was willing to take kids, tough old billies, sick sheep, lamed lambs. Valentine was interested more in quantity than future breeding potential. He warned them that there'd be some angry reapers coming up the track shortly, and they'd better clear out and play dumb. As the civilians moved away, the men of shit detail loaded the animals onto the boxcars. The toughest part was convincing Patel to leave the train with a squad of men to guide the hundreds of refugees into the hills.
Do I have to make it in order, Sergeant Major? I'd hate to fall back on rank.
It'll come to a fight when they catch up to you, sir. The men will need me.
I know the job now. I was lucky as a junior lieutenant. My captain put me with his best sergeant on my first operation in the Currian Zone.
Patel relented and walked around to the remaining NCOs, giving tips and hurrying up the loading of the livestock.
Give them hell, Billy Goat Legion.
Patel moved off with the crowds from the boxcars and into a hillside defile on the far side of the river. Patel wanted to put at least a ridge between the tracks and the life sign he was giving off before nightfall. David Valentine watched them go, silently wishing them luck. The animals he'd purchased but couldn't fit into the train, he left behind to muddle the tracks. They'd fuzz up the Reaper's sensing abilities for a few moments anyway. The smell of goats reminded him of his induction into the wolves. Valentine wondered what he'd say if he could have a talk with that kid he'd been. He thought of a young couple he'd noticed, clinging to each other in doubt as they looked back at the boxcars as Patel led them into the defile. How did they get selected for harvesting? Sterile? Passing out anti-Currian pamphlets printed in some basement? The woman had mouthed thank you in him. That goat-sniffing kid would have written Father Max a long letter about those two words.
It's worth it.
Valentine still had a few refugees, the old unable to make a long walk, the sick, and a few devoted souls who stayed behind to tend to them. He gave them a boxcar of their own just in front of the caboose. As the train passed across the bridge, he turned back to view it in the frosty twilight. The ties spun like blown dandelion tufts into the river. Now the question was whether they'd make enough of a life sign signal to draw the Reapers. He had what was left of his company, plus the refugees, plus whatever signal the sheep and goats would send. He sent another message to Sing, reporting the destruction of the bridge.
Scouts confirm you are being pursued. Two trains out of Lexington. The rear is heavily armored with engines at either end. Coming your way. Over.
A big boy might be managing the pursuit. Over.
GC will attend to it, Valentine. Instructions on the way. Over and out.
Valentine slowed their progress to a crawl, both to spot track obstructions more easily, and so they'd be more likely to spot a messenger. He smelled roasting goat in the refugee car, with tarragon and cumin, it seemed. the resourcefulness of soldiers in feeding themselves still found ways to amaze him.
Stopping. Rock slide.
Valentine's cat-sharp eyes made it plain. That ended it. Piles of sulfur-colored limestone had ended the chase. This was no tree that could be sawn and rolled, or blown. The rock slide would take his entire company, working with beams, chains, and the train engine to clear. At least half a day, working in daylight. Valentine caught a whiff of the improvised charcoal brazier they had set up under an air vent. Glass and the Grogs were eating chunks of goat meat toasted on skewers made from bed springs. Other members of the company dismounted from the train to take a look at the rock slide. Everyone shook their heads. It was a tight little corner of Kentucky, Valentine decided, looking at the steep hillsides to either side, the brack of complaining sheep and goats from the rail cars magnified by the cut. They'd come at least 10 miles. Horsemen or cyclists would be strung out, keeping up with the reapers. Would whoever was puppeting the reapers risk them? Valentine wondered if there was a finder's keeper's policy for the rail security Kurian. The hills around this cut would allow his troops to set up murderous crossfire. There'd be no danger of the men hitting each other. They'd be shooting down. There was a slight upward slope to the rail line. Valentine thought of the wild cart ride he'd taken down Little Timber Hill.
Ediac, Preville, set up company headquarters back in that rock pile. Try to make contact with the brigade.
Roger that, sir.
Valentine felt something tickling at the back of his scalp. He decided it was his imagination, fretting at the dark and the delay, with Singh still miles away. He put some men to work making stretchers from the rickety beds in the boxcars. He posted Glass and the two Grogs in the rocks above, at the source of the fall, having him take some illumination flares. The 50 would have a nice look down the cut from that point, and they could make a quick retreat over the ridgeline. He put Rutherford and DuSable on the other hill, just above the caboose, with a machine gun taken from one of the train's mounts. He made sure they had pistols with Quickwood magazines, loaded and ready. Valentine posted himself with the majority of the platoon around the caboose. The cupola gun in the engine could cover a quick fallback and serve as a rally point in the rock pile. Valentine posted Crow at the coupling between the engine and the boxcars. He walked from position to position, checking the men, checking that nagging itch at the back of his neck that was turning into a doubt, stiffening the hairs there. He told Bee to stay in the caboose. She'd be an unpleasant surprise to any reaper who clawed his way in. There were reapers somewhere off to the west. Or maybe it was the Kurian, reaching out with his senses, searching for his quarry. He headed back towards Company HQ. As he clambered up the rocks, he spotted Duvalier putting away her sword into the walking staff holder. He smelled sweat, rubber, and lubricating oil on her. Ediac's mouth was opening and shutting like a landed fish, and Preville trembled like his heart had been jump-started.
Sorry, guys. Had to make sure. Where's your major?
Right here.
3 hours on a bicycle bumping along a railroad. The things my poor body does for you.
That's it, Ediac. I'm shooting for senior rank.
Drink?
Thanks. Sang's got half the brigade on the way. The bears and what wolves he has left are on their way to the bridge you dynamited, along with some of the legworm troops. Karras gave another whoop-em-up speech and sent them off hollering. There's a big file of legworms following this track, too. They're tearing a bunch of new holes in their mounts, prodding them at speed.
Any orders for me?
Just to let him know if you found some good ground for an ambush.
Valentine let himself soar a little. Singh saw an opportunity to sting the Kurian's good and was grasping for the rose and not minding the nettles. Even if it drew lots of troops into this part of Kentucky, he'd be across another line of mountains by the time they could organize themselves.
Can you help me here?
Sure. Want me to brew up some of this Kentucky hickory nut coffee? Not like those cafes in the French Quarter, but it's hot.
Not that easy. The Reapers could be here at any time. I'd really like another trained hunter up with my men. You could jam yourself between a couple boxcars, wait for a chance to make a move.
Me? Oh, I'm a heroic kind of fighter, Val. When bullets start flying, I prefer to head the other direction.
I know. Just this once. Please, Allie.
No, Val. I don't like the odds. Multiple Reapers? At night?
Duvalier at least had the sense to refuse quietly. At most, Preville and Ediac heard her. Valentine wondered if she'd obey a direct order. Technically, Katz bore the rank of captain, but he suspected she'd tell him to get stuffed and bring her up on charges.
All right. How about a job more in line with your tastes?
I hope it doesn't involve climbing back on that bike.
No. I want you to scout out a good covered route away from the rails and up this ridge. Take Ediac with you and show her it. If a Reaper starts sniffing around our rear, take care of him. Or warn me.
That's more my style.
Ediac, go with Smoke here. Don't worry, she's just marking out a line of retreat. She'll keep an eye on you out in the dark.
Two eyes!
Duvalier smiled at Valentine's clerk. Ediac was rather good-looking at that. But then, the kind of Quislings who ended up in the Order's services had better access to nutrition and grew up well-formed. A soldier trotted up.
Sir, Red Dog is acting really weird. He's hiding under the sheep and whimpering. Harmony says they used to have a hound that acted the same way when they were the hoods around. He told me to get you.
Roger that. Smoke, you better make your exit now, or you won't have an option anymore.
Direction is the better part of valor. Shall we, Ediac?
Valentine was beginning to suspect Duvalier liked to misquote Shakespeare just to bug him. He reached into a cargo bag and extracted a flare pistol on a lanyard and a pouch of flares.
Don't get yourself taken, Val. One is my limit for heroic rescues.
Duvalier gave him a quick buss on the ear, standing on tiptoe to reach, kissing lightly enough that Valentine felt like Peter Pan brushed by Tink's wings. Then the Kentucky night swallowed her.